I was standing outside with this music paper, read that review, and I remember closing it and thinking, I am clearly no good at this. I should never have tried to do it again. I have to stop and I will never play my guitar again. And I didn't.
Welcome to Discography, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. And in this episode, albeit with tons of deferential idolatry, we'll be turning our spray cans on Vashti Bunyan, along with our very special guest, Vashti Bunyan herself, who will be going through her entire catalog, every single release she's ever had a hand in writing, performing, and or guesting on, and rating every last one from 0 to 5 stars. This is actually part two of an action-packed doubleheader in which most of the music she's ever made throughout her career is rated in this very episode. Look, if you know, then you know. But if you don't, then you ain't going nowhere, because right this second, finally, is your chance to stop embarrassing yourself around friends you give a shit about when the subject of Vashti Bunyan comes up. Tonight's guest is an English singer-songwriter who kicked off her career with a Stones-written pop song in the mid-1960s. She released her debut album, Just Another Diamond Day, 5 years later in 1970, after living homeless and traveling the UK countryside by horse in her quest for a utopian life, promised by an island paradise recently acquired by Donovan. Her record sold practically nothing, and Bunyan immediately put her career in mothballs for over 3 decades. By then, her once ludicrously obscure debut had acquired a large and devoted cult following. As if to make up for lost time, the second phase of her musical career has been jaw-droppingly productive. Vashti Bunyan is a legend. In this episode, we'll hear about the collaboration with Nick Drake that never was, how she really feels about Just Another Diamond Day, and why she didn't write or sing for over 30 years. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discography is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore an artist or band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got Deer Tick, Will Oldham, Bob Nastanovich, the Association rating the entirety of their own output, and Anthony Fantano, the origin story. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. Do it! And away we go then with Vashti Bunyan. The trip is over now, so to speak. I mean, because it's not really over. The trip to Sky, at least, is. And Joe Boyd delivers on his promise to record an album of your traveling songs right at the time you find out you're pregnant.
Yes. Yeah.
So from that moment until your third child leaves home 33 years later, you didn't write another song at all, and potentially ascribed your creative drive to your yearning for children.
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly it's what occurred to me, because Joe asked me to write a song for Judy Collins, and I sort of half wrote it. I've still got half of it. Every so often I go back to it and think, I just can't find that line, so I shelve it again. And I literally didn't write anything more. Once I knew that I was having this child that I had so longed for and thought from all kinds of things that had happened to me that I wouldn't be able to have another child. And that seemed to, it just felt as if the yearning for the child had been what had made the songs. And that once I had the child, the songs just didn't matter anymore and didn't happen anymore. And they really, truly didn't until my last one left home for an American college. All that time later, just in about 2003.
You're an anomaly to me because there are a handful, and I'm sure you're familiar with them as well, or at least most of them. There are a handful of female performers who've disappeared for decades and then came back and started recording again.
Yes.
You are the only one that I'm aware of who did that. And your work now is just as much, if not even more, critical. And it's like a magic trick. And we're going to get to that stuff, starting with Piano Magic, but that's decades later. From the very first Piano Magic song, it's like no time had passed at all. The sensibility, no change in the voice. It's weird.
It is weird. And it was weird to me because after Diamond Day came out again in 2000, I was approached by Glenn Johnson of Piano Magic. He'd written a song and he would really like me to record it. I haven't sung for 30 years. I don't know if I can sing. But I went down to London and I was standing in this studio in front of a microphone, and this voice came out. It was so incredible, really. And it was, I mean, I have likened it to having shut it away in a cupboard for so long and then opening the cupboard and it's still there. I was walking on air. I was just so happy to be in a studio again, to be with musicians again, and to be actually singing. It was fantastic.
We're jumping. We haven't even talked about Diamond Day.
Yeah.
But the fact that you were able to do that is, in a lot of ways, the most surprising aspect of your tale.
Well, I think so. And it was a huge surprise to me.
Sure.
And it made me want to start again. It made me want to try again. Because Diamond Day, just another Diamond Day, because the album came out in 1970, but I had a baby by the time it came out. You know, the songs were written throughout 1968 into 69. They were recorded at the end of 69. They didn't come out on the album until the end of 1970. And so they missed their time. You know, if I'd been able to put out that album at the end of 68 or even the end of 69, it might have worked better. But by time the end of 1970 into 71 came, you know, it was a totally different world and it didn't mean anything to anybody. But then when it came out again in 2000, it seemed to mean a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And to a generation that were the kind of age that I was when I was writing those songs. And it just, I don't know, it was kind of a miracle, really.
I'm jealous that you get to experience something like that because no one could know how something like that would feel.
And I can't describe it. Of course, I can't describe it.
And then, of course, during the 70s, you know, you refer in your book to the reason why people were listening to it in the 70s is because of Fairport People being on your record. But the interesting notion now is that in the year 2023, your sensibility is far more commanding as far as what people are influenced by than Fairport.
Oh, you think? Oh,
yeah.
That would have pleased me so much back in 1970. It's a shame, really, because the whole of Diamond Day, the whole of the album, I really didn't like it back in its day. And I wasn't surprised that it didn't go anywhere because it didn't feel like me. I loved the songs that were arranged by Robert Kirby, who had done Nick Drake's songs, although I didn't know Nick Drake at all or his music, but I loved what Robert Kirby did for my songs. The more folky kind of treatment of the songs didn't sit well with me when I heard it eventually. I mean, I didn't hear it for another year after we had recorded it. Well, 9 months maybe. But anyway, a long time. And I had my baby since then. And then I got this acetate from Joe Boyd sent from America. And I just didn't recognize myself. Some of the songs I did, but a lot of them I really didn't. I didn't have any faith in it at all. And neither did anybody else. It was never played anywhere. I never saw it in any shops or anything. Even my family didn't mention it. You know, it completely disappeared out of my life. And I have since met Joe Boyd, who said he apologized to me for having brought the folky musicians in to recording Diamond Day and making it so that I was part of that family of folk singers and that it had sort of condemned me to being called a folk singer for the rest of my life. And he apologized for that. But he said that when he visited me and Robert with our horse and our wagon and our dogs living out in the middle of nowhere. He thought we lived the most folky life of anybody he had ever come across. And so, of course, that's what he thought we were, what he thought I was.
That's the thing about the ways in which you chose to live. It really allows people's minds to run wild because people engage with it. Whatever kind of baggage they bring to the table as far as the notion of living free and living wild like that, you were living your own reality, which had nothing to do with that.
Yes. That's right. That's right. And yes, people's perception, so many different people's perception of it. And then when it all condensed into this album of songs, you know, I wrote the songs going along, not thinking that I would record them. They were just to keep us going. And so a lot of them were very rocky, like the swaying of the wagon. And I wasn't thinking of recording them. And then when I did record them and they came out not like I had intended, it was a bit of a shock and it was a bit of a heartbreak again that I hadn't been able to do what I wanted to do. I hadn't been able to make the songs sound the way I wanted them to sound.
If you compare what your intentions were to how some things just stick in your mind came out, how comparable is this to that experience?
Yeah, I know. I had moved on from that.
Did it feel like your authorial nature was entirely taken from you because of Joe's treatment?
Kind of. I think because I had recorded with Andrew Oldham and Peter Snell and those incredibly perfect, well thought out, edited versions of my songs where if there had been a bum note, it would be taken out.
You took out some of those bum notes.
Took out some of the bum notes, some of the delays, and it was all of that. When I heard it, when the acetate came to me, and also when I played it to my brother, he was heartbroken that he hadn't been able to do it himself. That it had come out completely differently to how we had both of us intended, you know. So, of course, I abandoned it for 30 years.
Let's drop the needle on this thing. I mean, look, for a true overview of the record, you really need to read the book because all the stories that inform the writing of the material is right there in the book. So I'm not going to dive too deeply into it. I thought about ascribing each of the songs as we went to the experiences that gave birth to them, but I feel like it's better suited for a reader to experience that.
That's very good. Thank you.
You know, as far as the songs themselves, I feel like the record, in a way, is beyond reproach. You don't feel that way, I'm sure, because, you know, you're the person who did it. But Diamond Day, right out of the gate, one of my favorite songs of all time. The arrangement and the material here, I think, is the perfect merger of each. I don't know if you feel similarly or you feel like it's off base.
I love it now. Okay. I have forgiven it now. I have understood that how it came about, how it was in Joe's mind, how it was in the other musicians' minds. And I really love it now. And the song Diamond Day, that was a Robert Kirby arrangement. And he just did it so perfectly, just understood what I meant so perfectly. And so that first song, Diamond Day, I would definitely give that a 5.
you don't have to rate all the songs.
I can't possibly, but if I were to, that would be the one that would have a 5.
Yeah, this is my favorite song on the record. As far as the production goes, it's a little bit more fleshed out than the rest of the record.
Yeah. On the other hand, I do love Rosehip November, which was just me and John James and Robin Williamson on harp and penny whistle. And it sounds very folky, but still, I love it. I love Rosehip November. I think it said what I wanted to say. The keyboard was the dulcet tone that had traveled with us, a fun little keyboard.
What exactly is that? What sounds like bells?
That's the dulcet tone.
Really amazing sound. Yeah. There's not a single song that I don't think is great. I do agree with you, but this is splitting hairs, that Jog Along Bass is, it's almost laughably jaunty. I do understand why you're not a huge fan of that one, but I am mystified as to why you really don't like it, right?
I didn't like the fiddle on it. You know, it was very kind of Robin to play it at all, but I prefer it with just the piano and the guitar. It wasn't supposed to be so jaunty, and the fiddle does make it very, very, very jaunty. It was meant to be just a story. The strange thing about writing that song was that I was in a miserable, damp, deserted glen in Scotland, sitting in the rain, sitting against a cold stone wall, and writing a song like Jog Along Bess, you know, one of the happier songs.
Yeah. Again, adding so much texture to the experience of the record, reading this, the memoir. So what do you do in a situation like Lily Pond, where you're writing what sounds like a pretty thinly veiled rewrite of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star?
Yes, exactly.
How does publishing work with that?
I actually can't remember what we did with that one, because I think it was out of copyright, the actual, you know, the original Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, but clearly that is it. In a way, it was a nod to the violin teacher I had when I was at boarding school, who made me play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star every week for a whole term until I couldn't play the violin anymore. I just absolutely left it behind. But that tune, I don't know, it stayed with me.
This record is, it's almost impossible to talk about. It really is just something that needs to be experienced. When I discovered it, there were very few people who I knew who were able to have an informed conversation about you. since then, thank God you've released other records and things of that nature, and now the memoir. I don't want to really dissect it too much. It's kind of perfect exactly how it is. And I transcribed it exactly how you say it in From Here to Before.
Uh-huh.
Diamond Day wasn't meant to be a folk record, and probably left to my own devices, it would have been a much more melancholy record than it turned out. I think now it's a wonderful picture of the time it was made in and all the musicians that were working at that time. And also it's representative of Joe at the time. I don't think it's necessarily representative of me at the time, although it looks it from here. It looks like the story. It looks like the hills. It looks like the rivers and the brackens and the beautiful sea. And it sounds like all of those things. But for me at the time, I wasn't living in the hills and the beautiful sea. I was living in my head.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So perfectly put. I mean, you know, that's the twist. If you know the record for a long time, I didn't pick these things up listening to it. The wish fulfillment fantasy was so all-encompassing that notion never even entered into my head that you were wishing so badly it would be like this instead of actually being like this.
Yes, exactly. It was a fantasy. It was a total fantasy. Turned out to be. But that journey did still inform the rest of my life, and the songs do represent it.
And, you know, the coolest thing about the record, and it is one of the all-time great, if you want to use the term, cult records that have ever been released, is that all your listeners are chasing a concept of what you went through, when at the time you mainly recollected is that you and Robert were wandering the countrysides doing just that, chasing concepts. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
That you were,
is
that? So, you know, the more and more I think about it, and I've been thinking about your work nonstop for weeks now, is that you're wandering the countryside chasing ideas, and then people listening to your work are chasing those same ideas. It's almost like the reality of it is the fantasy or something.
Different people will find different things in the songs. And also, I've heard from so many people who've told me that the songs are comforting in bad times when they are feeling bad themselves, in the same way that I was feeling bad when I took on that journey.
Yeah.
That I wrote the songs to comfort myself and to keep me and Robert going. And maybe that comes across in them to some people, that they are calming and comforting in some kind of way. I've told this story before, that I had a wonderful message from a man who had an autistic child who was nonverbal, but he would sing all the songs of Diamond Day and know the words perfectly. That really got me. Yeah. I don't know what kind of a state my head was in at the time I was writing the songs, but I was certainly writing them to calm myself down. And if they calm other people down, especially children, then that's a job done, isn't it?
So all these years later, with all the grappling you've done with the legacy of what this work is, on this particular evening where you are today, what do you give this record?
The whole record of Just Another Diamond Day?
Yeah.
I think at the time I would have given it a 2, and now I give it a 5.
Good. Oh, thank God. I was holding my breath. And then, so before this thing was released, at Joe Boyd's urging, you got together with Nick Drake and futilely tried to generate a collaborative spark. I'm a huge fan of his. I can only imagine how awkward that situation may have been based on your writing of it. Anything that you remember about there being anything that was good that came out of it or no?
Oh, nothing. No, he had his back to me. I was sitting on the sofa with my baby and my guitar guitar, and every time I picked up my guitar, my baby would cry. And I don't know why there wasn't somebody else that I could hand the baby over to, but there doesn't seem to have been. Nick was just sort of messing about on the piano, and because I couldn't join in any way, we just sort of quietly gave up. And I went home with my baby and my guitar. Nothing ever came of it. And now Joe thinks, you know, what was he thinking? That, you know, he knew both of us. He knew that we were both uncommunicative. Neither of us knew the other's music. And, you know, what was he thinking? And now he says, what was I thinking? It was never going to work. Never going to work. We were both very individual. And I think we were both fairly protective of our own songs.
Yeah.
And the thought of writing with another person, that wasn't going to work, even if it was Nick Drake.
Look, sensibility-wise, it makes sense, but maybe personality-wise, it doesn't.
Oh, personality, no. And time, yeah. And I think he was already getting very ill, and it just really wasn't going to work.
At the time when the record came out, you were living in the incredible string band Scientological compound, and you read a single review where the person said that the record upset them. And mm-hmm. just based on that one review... you said, well, that's it for that. I'm never doing that again. And so that's it. You kind of, you packed it up. Not kind of.
I really, really, really packed it up. It was because the reviewer said that listening to the album had made him feel depressed.
Right.
And I thought, how could I have done something so dreadful to somebody to make them so unhappy with that album? I was standing outside number 2 Glen Row with this music paper, read that review, and I remember closing it and thinking, I am clearly no good at this. I should never have tried to do it again. I have to stop, and I will never play my guitar again. And I didn't. So power of those kinds of reviews. And, you know, people say the good reviews, you don't remember them, but the bad ones stick in your head forever. And that's true. It did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, after we get off the phone, maybe you'll only remember my 3-star review of 17 Pink Sugar Elephants. But yeah, it sucks when you're an artist, you're opening yourself up for criticism, and there's that sensitivity that normal people can't even connect with. So in the next 27 years or 26 years, mm-hmm. from 1971 until that day where you scratched your chin and decided to walk over to the computer and look up your name.
That was in 96, yes.
96. You raised 3 children. You furiously backpedaled against anyone finding out that you had this prior existence.
Yes, absolutely. My kids, well, later on, they told me that they found an old tape copy of the Diamond Day album, because I didn't have any original copies, that somebody had made me a tape and I'd shoved it away. But the kids would take it out to the car and play it there. And I never knew, because I had forbidden them to listen to it. I mean, how crazy is that? But anyway,
it's not crazy. There's a lot of pain that can go into one's, I'm a filmmaker. I've made 2 movies, and I've never been able to figure out how to successfully divorce myself from the work.
Right. Yes, it's very hard. Very hard. And even when people say wonderful things about it, it's still hard.
One day in 1996, you have a sudden notion. You walk over to your computer, turn mm-hmm. that thing on, and you type your name into a search engine, which winds up changing the rest of your life.
Yeah, I typed my name into AltaVista. It was pre-Google. There was no Google yet.
Hey, lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3-times-a-week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Friday, a Monday wildcard episode, which is either a soul-bearing interview with that week's special guest, or an offshoot show like Queasy Listening and Rock Cousteau. And then on Wednesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. This brings us to phase three. Just another life to live. But thank God this is how you chose to live it, Vashti. 2000 to write the second. This leads to July 2000, the reissue of Just Another Diamond Day. You know, 1,000 things come tumbling out of that event.
Oh, so, heavens, yes. Really. I mean, even just finding the master tape that had been in a tape library for 30 years, you know, and actually finding it and getting it and being able to put out Diamond Day again was extraordinary. But one of the most extraordinary things that happened when we were preparing it for release was taking the master tape into a studio and hearing it for the first time through big speakers, when I'd only ever heard it on you know, scratchy record players or scratchy tapes. And to hear what Joe did for the first time was a revelation. It was an amazing day, an extraordinary day to hear it, really, and to have a little bit more faith that when it was to come out again on this tiny little label, and you know, I thought, oh goodness, you know, it's going to happen again, it's going to be dismissed as nursery rhymes and silly stuff. But it didn't, and it was, you know, wonderful, wonderful reviews and people saying stuff about it that I would, oh goodness, if it had happened back in 1970, well, my life would have been very different. And I don't regret those 30 years at all. I really don't. I've said that before, but it was just extraordinary to have people say what I would have loved to have said about it back then. Yeah. But to be here now, to be here still, to be able to hear what people think of it is extraordinary. And when I met Robert Kirby again, when we were recording in 2005, he said to me, well, we're the survivors. And that's absolutely how I feel, that I've survived it. Many haven't, and I've survived it. And I have people like you saying lovely things about that album. And I could never have imagined that that would happen.
Yeah. Well, so, to me, it wasn't just that album. I mean, like I said, the entirety of your work tells a real story when put together. All of the pieces are crucial to understand the whole story. How did Piano Magic's Crown of the Lost happen?
Oh, well, Paul Lambden, who put together the Spinny label to put out Diamond Day, he was contacted by Glenn Johnson of Piano Magic, who said that he had a song he would like me to sing. And I think I've said before, I didn't know if I could sing, but I went down to London and I could sing. And it was a most extraordinary door opening for me. The song, I found it quite difficult to sing the song because it's somebody else's song, but I was just so grateful to have that chance. And later on, I did another song for Piano Magic, which Dark Ages. I think that the way they recorded my voice for Dark Ages was the best it's been recorded ever.
Wow. They're very different. The two tracks, the first one is much more in your typical style. The second one has a gothic darkness about it, which is a twist on what you usually do.
Yes, it was. And I really enjoyed the difference. I loved that song as well. And it was so different to anything I'd ever done. That was great.
Yeah, it's a crazy reintroduction. So I'm thinking of one person in particular. I'm not going to say the name, but it was a similar situation as yours. Decades went by, the person came back, released a record, and it felt really soporific and new agey to me. Mm-hmm. Your stuff is brimming with intensity in the same way, if not more so, you know, because you have the reality of decades of lived in experience conjoined with, you know, for lack of a better term, that nursery rhyme quality. So it gives it a texture that is crucial, I think, to understanding the early stuff too.
Right.
But Crown of the Lost, I would give 5 stars. One of the most befuddlingly impressive from out of nowhere comebacks I've ever heard. And then in 2004, Dark Ages, I give that 4 stars. I don't like it quite as much as you, but they're still so ridiculously of high quality.
Yeah, I think the recording of it, the production of it was amazing. And the guitarist, I thought he was wonderful. I can't remember his name, which is terrible, but he was incredibly good. And well, Piano Magic as a band and Glenn Johnson's songs, I just had great admiration for them.
So what do you give these to? If you want, you can bow out of rating other people.
Writers Without Homes, I would give 4, I think, because I was quite uncertain in my singing. But with Dark Ages, I was much more confident. So I think I would give that 5.
Cool. And then that same year, you were adopted as the den mother of the freak folk movement, thanks to Evandra Banhart, who reportedly writes your name on his arm before some concerts. Do you find that disconcerting?
I don't think he does anymore.
You feel hurt that he doesn't anymore?
I don't think so. I think it was when he was first going out and playing to people, those nerve-wracking first shows that he did. I think that he did write my name on his arm, and somebody saw it and wrote it down on Wikipedia or somewhere like that, that Devendra Banhart writes her name on his arm when he goes out to sing. All but, right. You know, that was very early days. I'm sure he doesn't do it anymore.
Yeah, the golden apples of the sun is basically the Rosetta Stone or the Ur-text of the Greek folk movement. And there you are with Devendra on Rejoicing in the Hands, which feels like a Diamond Day era mainstay, like not even an outtake. It feels like, you know, there's sort of a sing-song aspect to the melody, which has a similar vibe. Did you have a hand in writing the song as well?
No, not at all. No. And it was when I was first recording stuff for myself at home. I think after Diamond Day came out, and the first royalty check I got was such a shock, and it was just so wonderful. And I went out and I bought a Mac, one of those great big enormous ones. Back then, and a keyboard and a little mixer and some music software. And I was just beginning. And Devendra sent me his song, and I was able to put my part on the top and send it back to him across the Atlantic. And that was such a great thing to be able to do, something I had never imagined I would be able to do. But I didn't write the song at all. I actually got the words pinned to the back of my door still.
Nice. I love this song. This is a hard 5 stars for me. I love it.
Rejoicing in the Hands. Oh my goodness. Yes. Well, it's a crazy song, but yes, I loved it. And I sang my part, sent it back. And we've done that a few times since. It works out really well. But that very first time seemed like a miracle. You know, I could record something here in Edinburgh and send it to him in California. And oh, my goodness.
I'm guessing this is a 5 for you.
Yes, definitely. Rejoicing in the Hands, because it was my first outing with Devendra's songs. I think, yes, definitely a 5 for that.
Around this time, I remember thinking, like, this is amazing. Not only, you know, she's been gone for such a long time, but now it's like you're shooting out sparks all over the place. Every few days, it seemed like there was some mention of you on Pitchfork. And, you know, of course, Prospect Hummer comes out with Animal Collective at that time. That really blew me away. I was a fan of theirs. And then to hear your twin sensibilities merging like that.
Yes. So good.
It's a real good fit.
It was wonderful time because they were on tour here, but they had 3 days off. And so we spent those 3 days, a song a day.
Yeah.
They had sent me a tape of the songs. And I thought, yeah, lovely, great songs. And I thought, I was going to be just a backing singer and you know, put a few little bits in. And when I got there, they had me at the front. wait a minute. But they just pushed me and pushed me and pushed me. And it was the best 3 days. It was just brilliant. Brilliant to be with them. Brilliant to see their genius as well, that they are so focused and so determined and so know what they want and they get it.
And that was a really inspired period for them. Sung Tongues.
It was.
And it sounds kind of like your work. It sounds like, you know, kids playing in a sandbox. Yours has a more somber quality to it. I'm talking about the 60s stuff, but it's not that far removed to think of the two things coming together.
Yes. And I didn't know their music at that time at all. I hadn't listened to them. But once I did, I really understood what they wanted to do. It took a little while from when we recorded it to when it came out, and I'd more or less forgotten about it. But when I heard it again, I was so happy with what they'd done with the vocals.
I especially like what they did with your voice on It's You. I don't know if you're improvising words, but the rushes of harp with your vocals sort of sandwiched in between is incredibly affecting.
Yeah. Well, that's them. That's what they were doing. Yeah, I think I was swept along and I was just able to do what they wanted of me and also to put a bit of myself into it.
5 stars.
Yeah.
Now, of course, let's move on to Dead Pets. Okay. All right. right. So for those who don't know, that's your original title, which I think is pretty cool. I do prefer Look Aftering, but especially because it's so not a gentle name.
Well, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a little bit shocking. I wasn't allowed because Fat Cat, the label, when I suggested that, you know, Dead Pets, they said, well, that might work in the UK, but it will not work in the USA. It won't go down. So I said, well, why not? What's the difference? But anyway, I wasn't allowed to use it. So
I don't know if you know this, but Miley Cyrus, several years after this, used that.
Yes, yeah. I do know. And it made me extra cross.
You should have sued her. All right. This one is unique to my ears because it feels to me there's like a dark, knotty vibe of deep forest magic and wonder on here, some of which is provided by Max Richter, but some of it is also in the songwriting. There's a mystery to it that separates it a little bit from your work. I don't know if I'm reading into it, but the sound of it, it's a slightly subverted twist on the pure innocence of Diamond Day, but still a variation on the old magic that happens when you don't hide your light. What the perfect summary from your book: during the mastering, I'd realized that the songs were a lot about looking back, where my first album had been so much about looking forward. I love this one. I know you see a difference and a distinction between Look Aftering and Heartleap, which came next. How do these two coexist for you in your mind?
Look Aftering was a revelation to me, to be working with Max Richter, to understand how he worked. And we came to a lot of the arrangements together. I had made the demos and given them to him, and he had embellished some of them, left them exactly as they were, some of them. But what he did was to put real instruments into it, whereas my demos had all been synths. So I had to understand that he wanted to make it all real people.
Right.
And partly I was determined that I was going to use a lot of synthesized sounds and do it the way I wanted to do it, more like the demos for Look Aftering. Whether it worked or not, I'll never know. But for Look Aftering, it seemed to be a much more conventional way of recording, that we went into studios. We recorded other people and other instruments, and it was beautifully put together in the end. You know, we took it all back to Max's studio here in Edinburgh. We sat side by side and edited it together. That was great for me. That was a great education for me to how it all worked. And I was able to use a lot of that education for doing my own production for Heartleap.
Right.
All those years later.
His touches are really tasteful, especially my favorite song on the record is Here Before.
Wow. Yeah, what he did for Here Before was just magical.
Are those wine glasses?
Yes, he brought in, well, we both brought in a whole lot of wine glasses to the studio, and he borrowed his little gal's violin bow, which is a very tiny one. We filled them with water up to the tone that we wanted for each glass, and he played them. I've got a beautiful photograph of him doing that, actually, of Max playing the wine glasses.
That is a scarily good song. We were just in Vermont driving around in impossibly beautiful nature, and playing that during that section, my wife was like, whoa, what is this? This is amazing. It really has, for me, an almost synesthetically related sonic version of what feels to me like light peeking through trees.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
It is. And he was very uncertain. He had been working on it himself. And when he played it to me, he said, what do you think about this? I thought it was just wonderful, absolutely beautiful. I would never have thought of that myself, to bring all those echoes and the different voices. And it's just, well, it's Max. Max is a genius.
You know, amazingly, to be able to achieve these kinds of high-reaching ambitions and then to say, I want to just work by myself now. Again, that's why you have balls that are way, way bigger than anyone listening to this show, because you're not going to stay in one place for very long.
Yeah.
But there's not a single song that I would say is less than great on Look Aftering, which is a miracle. You're not practicing your songcraft. You're not keeping up with music or with even taking the guitar down off the wall.
Uh-huh.
The fact that you're able to have come up with this means you're a true artist in a way that no one can really understand, because it lives within you.
Well, yeah, and it surprised me that I could actually do it after all that time of not being able to do it. I think for Look Aftering, neither Max nor I wanted it to be filled with songs that weren't as good as the others are. You know, we didn't want filler songs to make it longer. We just wanted the ones that we both reckoned were good songs. And oh, Max, I think I've said in the book, he was so wonderful. You know, compared to all the kingly producers I'd ever worked with, Max was so kind. And after every take, he would say, "Oh, that's such a good song. Now let's do it one more time."
Right.
It was beautiful. It made me laugh and it relaxed me and made me feel all right. And I'll be forever grateful to Max for that.
I love the whole record. The first side especially is packed with gorgeous songs. And it really does have a very wistful vibe, it feels like, although I can't say for sure if this is the case, it feels like you're wrestling with maybe some of life's regrets, or it has that vibe anyway. It's just a very beautiful autumnal feeling record. I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. I think it's wonderful.
Lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. I think I would go along with that. 4.5 is just perfect. Yes.
Awesome.
Well, 5 would be perfect, but 4.5 is about kind of how I feel about Look After Ing. You know, sometimes when I listen to some of the songs, I think, why did I let that note go in there? That didn't belong. I should have stopped it at the time. I really wish I could remix the whole thing. You know, there are some things you must feel that about filmmaking, that, you know, how do you get to the end where you know you've finished?
I believe there is an end point. I know there are artists who feel like it's never really done.
Yes.
But I believe if you're really listening to your work, it'll tell you what it's supposed to be. And mm-hmm. So if you continue tinkering past a certain point, that's ego.
Oh, you're completely right. Yes. And I've got a huge one, Minik. When it comes to every note has to be in the right place.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I get that. I do. And I'm not using the word ego in a, you know, accusatory way. We've all got one.
I know that I have a huge ego about the songs, you know, the more recent one. Well, actually, what is awful about me and what my partner Al thinks is terrible about me as well is that if I listen to somebody's cover of one of my songs and if they haven't got the chord sequence completely right, or if they haven't got the phrasing the way it's supposed to be, I get really agitated. Now, what kind of a control freak does that? I should be really honored that anybody should be covering any of my songs instead of getting agitated that they got it wrong.
No, it makes sense to me. Look at what you went through in the 60s. So much of your stuff was shelved. So many men coming on board thinking they know what's best for you. It's surprising to me that you're not litigious, for God's sake. Really? I mean, you know, certainly earned the right to have that attitude.
Yeah. Well, that and getting angry at being called a folk singer, I think poor Al. He put up with an awful lot.
I'm sure Al wakes up blessing the skies up above every day for his good fortune. So the next year, you get to cash in, but in a great way, because let's face it, Bob Dylan sold The Times They Are Changing to a bank. Mm-hmm. So when you have something that's ineffably removed from commercial considerations that then becomes a commercial, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it adds to the song. It doesn't take away. I mean, look, Nick Drake, Pink Moon, car commercial.
I've always thought about Nick Drake and Pink Moon, and wouldn't he have delighted in that? Would he have delighted, or would he have said, no, you can't have it? I don't think he would have refused it. I don't know. I don't know how he would have felt about it. But on his behalf, I'm really pleased that Pink Moon brought so many more people to know his music.
Yeah.
For me, when Diamond Day was taken up by T-Mobile, I was thrilled to bits. Really, it brought people to know the songs. And Robert Kirby at the time said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about all the people who are disappointed with you and cross with you for letting this happen. Music is meant to be heard.
Yeah.
And that really cheered me up that he said that I didn't have to hide away and be, you know, be sorrowful to people that I'd done something terrible and I'd sold out. I was delighted, really. Yeah, it meant a lot. It meant a lot.
I mean, I think we're also way past the time where this is considered a crass move. Yeah, we're past that as a society. So, you know, keep selling them, please. And And then that next year, you got to legitimize or justify having stored those suitcases and photographs in your brother's attic for so long with the release of the double CD of Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind.
Yes.
That is awesome that exists. I bought that the day it came out.
Oh, did you? Goodness. Oh, lucky again. Fat Cat and I had put together all the demos that we could find and my brother's tape and 17 Pink Sugar Elephants, all of that. And it was just going to be one CD. But at the same time that we were doing all of that, I discovered the 1964 tape that my brother had kept. And so we decided to put it all as it is, as it was, without editing it in any way, just as it was, and put it in as CD2. You've said that it would stand alone, but I think it's quite good to have that, as well as the ones that I did with Andrew and the ones I did with Peter Snell and other recordings with other people like my brother, for one CD, and then that completely complete tape on the other CD. They kind of complement each other in a way, or at least I hope they do.
Well, it's everything that set you on the journey.
Oh, goodness, yes. Yeah.
Gotta have it all together. And then 2007 was a pretty busy year for you. You did The Fire with Rod Glass from Ballads of the Book compilation, three songs from Anthony Reynolds' LP British Ballads, Devendra Banhart's My Dearest Friend, and Migrating Bird from the Songs of Lowell Waterson.
Whew.
A lot of stuff. Fire, I give 3 stars. The British Ballads, I'm not going to consider this part of the canon of your material because Anthony Reynolds is too kind of dominant in the proceedings.
My goodness,
But then My Dearest Friend, that's 4.5 stars. Migrating Bird, 4.5 stars.
Wow. Oh, Migrating Bird, I gave 2 because...
Really?
Oh, dear. When I recorded it and I sent it off and they put the tracks together wrong. They're just timed wrong. And I couldn't do anything about it because they'd already put it out. It just annoyed me so much that the person who was putting the CD together hadn't understood what I had done. I don't know what they did, but... I can't listen to it.
Oh, wow.
And so I've given it 2.
Wow.
But the Fire. Oh, you've put in the same bit different from Not Alone compilation, the St. Etienne one, and I can't find it. I know that it was all wrong. It wasn't the same bit different. It was another song altogether. But The Fire from Ballads of the Book with Roger Glass, I was listening to it today. I think it's really good. They put together a musician and a poet for the musician to make a song out of the poet's poem. And so I made that song out of his poem, The Fire. And we did record it together. And then I put a whole lot of different bits and pieces in on top. And I think, it's actually quite good. So I've given that one a 4.
Oh, cool. Cool. And then what about My Dearest Friend?
My Dearest Friend, do you know, I had forgotten that I'd done that one. And I thought, did I actually sing the vocal in the back of that one? And so I've looked for it. And yes, I did. I have to admit, I've completely forgotten doing it. But it's actually lovely.
It's beautiful. It's so pretty.
Dear Devendra, it's a really beautiful, beautiful bit of recording. I'm really proud that I did actually do it, even though I can't remember.
That guy is your brother from another mother, for sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And we've just done another recording together. So that's really
good.
He's something else, that's for sure.
And then in 2008, you got a couple tracks, Vetiver, Sleep a Million Years from Thing of the Past.
Yes, I loved doing that one. That's a beautiful song.
Yeah, and it's a nice change of pace because it's more skippity boppity than tunes that you normally do. And Arthur, My Dear, which I believe you did with Max Richter from a Mojo CD. That is gorgeous. Oh my God, the harp and the bells.
Yeah.
When your friends line up to help you out, they really deliver.
Oh, I know. And Max was so great. We recorded that in his studio. And halfway through the recording, his wife called to say that their little baby had the most terrible cold and she was really, really, really ill and he needed to come home. And so he did. And so we might have done more to it, but the way that it is the way that it was. And actually, it's lovely.
It's my favorite of all your covers. It's my absolute favorite cover.
Really? Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, I enjoyed singing that one.
So I'll give Sleep a Million Years 3 stars. I'll give Martha, My Dear 5.
Oh, right. Great. Oh, okay. I'll give it 5 as well in honor of his little baby who did get better.
In 2009, Robert Kirby unfortunately passes away. You decide that he's irreplaceable, so you decide to carry on recording all by yourself.
Yes. Well, there was another part that I haven't put into the book, that Joe Boyd was doing these lovely tribute shows to Nick Drake and had a lot of artists playing his different songs. And I got to do Which Will, which I didn't enjoy doing very much because Nick Drake's phrasing is almost impossible to try to replicate. You know, I didn't feel I'd done a good enough job of it.
It's on the compilation Way to Blue.
It is on the Way to Blue.
Is it live?
Yes, okay. It is. Kate St. John, who is the musical director, they were going to try to help me to record more songs for a new album. And Joe Boyd said to me, you know, that would be a really, really good idea because they'd make you sound so much stronger. So that was for me. I don't want to be made to sound anything different to
right.
me. And that's when I decided, after Robert Kirby died, that I really didn't want to be made to sound stronger. I decided that I would do it for myself. I had learned an awful lot from sitting next to Max Richter when he was editing the songs for Look Aftering. And I think I've said in the book that I tried to enroll in a music technology course at a local college.
They told you were too old, then you went and did it.
They told me I was too old and I wouldn't be able to understand it. My God.
Did they really say, they use those words?
You won't be able to understand it, so it'd be a waste of your time. You know, what?
What the hell is wrong with people to say stuff like that?
I know, but it just made me determined that I was going to learn it for myself, which I did.
Well, you know what? Here's a great example of how somebody can learn over time. You know, 40 years previous to this, somebody writes that they got depressed by your record and you vowed never to record again. And now, look at you, right? It's a completely different kind of response. There's
oh, yes.
a sign of growth.
I grew up.
Yeah. And so in 2010, you record what has to be the oddest song in your catalog, Dudley Benson's Tui.
Tui, yes, I
Man,
know.
Man, is that a weird song. If I had to create a category for it, it would be doo-wopra.
Oh boy, yes, that was a funny one, but he was such a lovely person. He was such a lovely guy. I really wanted to do it. I haven't listened to it recently, but I guess I should.
I had never heard this one. This was something that, you know, for this, I heard for the first time and I was like, whoa, that's so strange. Yes. I love it. You know, and just for being completely unique, just on that alone, I'll give it 4 stars.
Lovely. Oh, that's nice. He would be pleased. Yes, I would give it 4 as well. Yeah.
And then 2011, you're doing a tour of all the incredibly troubled male singer-songwriters of Britain. So John Martin is up next with Head and Heart.
Oh, really, what a beautiful song.
I'll give that one 4 stars. That's a great song, great version.
Well, it was fun doing that. And the person who was editing and producing it in America was so kind. I had a terrible buzz going on from my guitar. And in order to cover that, he put a kind of sea tidal kind of sound over the front of it to cover up my buzz and put all kinds of other things into it. I think he did a really good job. I quite like it. I would give that a 4.
Awesome. Look at this. We're agreeing on everything. All right, I'm not going to say my ratings anymore. I want to see if you actually agree. Okay, so We or Me, again, this is something I had not heard until this. I'm going to use the F word here. It does sound like a folk traditional.
It's a folk singer. Yeah, it's a folk singer. He was a friend of Iris McFarlane, the Iris of Iris's song.
Sure.
And he had a different version of Iris's song, but he knew her well. And he came to Edinburgh and asked me if I would just record a little bit for him. And I did that. And it came out on his Walking Hour CD. And it's not something that I put a huge amount into, but it was very nice that he did it because of the link to Iris. That's why I did it.
The vantage point that I had in listening to it was, for weeks, I had just been whispered to about what a dreadful word folk was. So I'll give this one 3 stars. Instead of 4 or 5, just based on
okay.
that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, yeah, you know, it's fine. It was fine.
It's the power of suggestion that you have. And then, Which Will from Way to Blue, that's a solid one. I didn't realize it was live.
It was, yeah. And we did did quite a few shows. So no, that one was chosen out of one of the shows. And actually, I would have chosen a different version. But goodness, it was so hard. It was so hard doing those shows, singing Nick's songs, and especially Which Will, which is such a particular song of his that it was very hard for me to try and emulate him. Later on in other shows, we did a different song, The Thoughts of Mary Jane.
Right.
I did that one, and I thought that was much better. That was more my kind of singing, really. But Which Will, it still gives me nightmares, actually, trying to sing it, because some of it is pitched so high and some of it is so low, but I tried my best.
What do you give this one?
3.
Yeah, me too. Obviously, the circumstances are very different, but do you feel any kind of kinship with Nick Drake because he retained that early mystery and then disappeared in his own way?
I think I have never really wanted to be sort of holding Nick's coattails, as it were. I feel that we were so different and that he was so far ahead of me in so many ways. As a musician, as a guitar player, as a songwriter, as a person, he was quite different. The only thing we really share is a very similar upbringing, a very similar middle-class protected upbringing, which probably didn't prepare us for the savagery of the music industry. That's the only thing that we really shared, and we would never have known that about each other. But I know that about him now, how incredibly ill it made him. And I feel so sorry that he didn't make it.
Yeah, he's inarguably the full package. His skill, specifically on Which Will, actually, his skill as a guitar player is astounding. Mm. Then as a songwriter and a vocalist, you put all these elements together, and it really is staggering the level of talent that he was operating from.
It's staggering. And when I went to see Robert Kirby, when I was planning to make another album after we'd met each other again doing these Nick Drake shows with Joe Boyd, I went to his house, and there in the corner was Nick's guitar. And oh my goodness, it was so wonderful that he had it, you know, that he had rescued it and he had it. It was just beautiful. I didn't dare even pick it up.
You should have done what you did with the albums that Oldham gave you to write. Just run.
Run.
It was cool to read about this in the book, because I didn't know that Heartleap was sort of a full circle thing back to that young girl in 1964 who walked into that studio on Denmark Street, I'm guessing. Was it in Denmark Street?
It was around the corner from my house. No, it wasn't Denmark Street. Okay. It was just some little old recording studio around the corner from my home.
It's just, you know, as close to that as I guess you've gotten in 55 years. Yeah.
That was what I wanted to do. And I didn't want to upset Max and all the people who had helped me with Look Aftering and Fat Cat and everybody by saying, oh, no, I'm going to do this all by myself. I don't need you. That wasn't my intention. My intention was to try to get back to the kind of innocence that I had when I was making that first, that first tape. Uh-huh. 1964, when I had those songs and I just had me and my guitar, I wanted to get back to that kind of simplicity, that kind of just me. And I know that it's ego and I know that it's control freakery, but I just wanted to try it. I didn't know if it was going to work or if Fat Cat were going to be able to release it or anything, but I just worked for a long time after Robert Kirby died, and I had gotten over it. Well, it took me 2 years to get over his death and to start making it for myself. It took a long time, not so much to write the songs, but just to figure out how to record them and how to make them the way I wanted them to be. And I think I did it.
It's amazing that you had never had any experience recording before this.
Yeah.
You did it all. You wrote, recorded, edited, arranged, produced, and mostly played everything, right? Except the arrangement of strings and Across the Water?
Yes, exactly. The rest was mine. Yeah. And that was Fiona and Ian Birch. They just came up with that one day when we were rehearsing for a show and I happened to record it. You know, it was just off the cuff. It was a lovely arrangement and I wanted to keep it. But the rest of it was all arranged by me.
Were you starting to compose more on the piano by this point?
Yes.
What precipitated that change?
I can't play the piano. I absolutely can't play the piano. But with my music program and with it sitting on my computer screen, I was able to record what would have been the right hand. And then the next track, I could record what would have been the left hand and put them together and make it sound as if I could play it. But I couldn't. I could only play one note at a time and then edit it. That was the most wonderful, joyful experience that I could actually do it that way. I could fake myself. And I really love that. Now, there's a song called Mother on Heartleap where actually there are three piano parts. So, you know, I was wondering if we ever do this live, will anybody be able to do it with three hands?
Yeah, I mean, Mother actually has, I wouldn't say it sounds like chopsticks, but it has a similar kind of simplicity to chopsticks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. That's perfect.
I'm not very much of a lyrics guy, especially when a performer or a writer has created an air of beauty and mystery. I don't want to shatter that by then tying the song down to one meaning. So I had never heard or listened to the lyrics to Mother until they were in your book. Mm. And, you know, so the song is obviously forever changed to me now. Okay. So the piano melody in Mother, is that based on one that your mom would have played? Or were you trying to play something that sounds like something she would have come up with?
I was trying to play it in the way that I thought that slightly out of tune piano that I witnessed her playing would have sounded, just slightly out of tune and slightly wonky and not completely right. Yeah, I was trying to conjure up the way that I felt about her when I watched her playing. It was actually a tune I'd had for a while, but it just seemed to fit the lyrics for Mother. You know, I can't remember actually how I come up with songs at all. Once they're done, and I can't remember how it happened.
Creative amnesia.
Oh, yeah. That's good, yes.
I believe more than any of your other LPs, this one hangs together and sounds all of a piece more so. It feels like one long song. I'm wondering if that was intentional.
In a way, yes. I think I don't remember actually writing the songs particularly, but the recording of them and the editing later. Oh boy, that took so long. Getting rid of all the clicks and bashes and all the rest of the horrible bits. And, you know, it took me 3 months to edit out the bad bits. And then when I got to the studio for the mastering engineer, Mandy Parnell, she said, "Oh, we've got a program that could have done all of that for you."
Mandy, of course, being the one who rejected that bet.
Oh, Mandy Parnell is the most wonderful mastering engineer ever. And I really adore her.
Is this really your final record?
Well, what happened, and I've told it before, is that when we were doing the mastering, at the end of the mastering, after 5 days or whatever it was, the mixing and the mastering together, it took us 5 days. But she turned to me when we'd finished and said,
"I want to do the next one." And you said,
Next time, I'm going to come up to your studio and put it right because it's really awful. Yeah. And I said, "I'm never doing this again," because it had been so intense, you know.
I know that's what you said, but A, did you really believe it? And B, 9 years later, are you really thinking this is it?
I haven't written another song. I mean, the end song on Heartleap itself.
Yeah.
When I was writing it, and it just came as a stream of consciousness, when I was looking at my daughter's painting of the White Heart, which is on the cover, it just came to me straight off all at once. And I thought, oh, well, maybe this is the song I always wanted to write and never could, but here it is. And this is the one, and maybe I'll never write another one. And in fact, I haven't. I don't know if I talked myself into it being the last one or if something one day will just pop up again. I don't know.
You went 32 years without writing a song and then an unstoppable geyser occurred. Do you really, truly in your heart feel that you said all you had to say with Heartleap?
I did at the time. And when I listen to it now, I think, yeah, I said all I wanted to say about love and heartbreak and the cyclical nature of life. But whether it is the last one I ever do, I mean, my head is full of yelling about the way things are now in the world. Why can't I write about it? Why can't I bring a song out? You know, I should be writing about how things are. And I can't find the words because it's so terrifying. It's so horrendous to me in the same way that it was when I left London with the horse and a cart fleeing for the hills.
At least up until the present day, it's not something you really do is to talk about how things are.
No.
You talk about it strictly from your perspective, which sheds way more light on the subject of how things are than if you had addressed it head on.
Well, sometimes I think that Diamond Day was the song that I wrote that would say it all for me. It's kind of all you need is love. That's what my song was. And maybe that was enough. I don't know. I sometimes feel frustrated with myself that I haven't been able to find the words to say that, you know, everything is wrong.
I look at your three records and it feels like a trilogy that hangs together and communicates specific ideas. And if there was more to it, it would be superfluous. You know, if that's the case, you could have made those three records in 70, 71, 72, and then not done anything for 50 years. I think you put the gap or the ellipsis in the appropriate place. In other words, after Diamond Day, but before Look After and Heartleap.
Right. Well, I hope you're right. I really do. Well, you know what it's like to doubt yourself.
Yes.
Maybe you don't.
But, I do. Yeah. No, I very much do. Believe me.
Right.
You had three more songs before you truly hung up your hat, although we'll see if that's actually the case. But three more songs. In 2018, Nick Drake again, The Thoughts of Mary Jane for Mojo. I give that one 5 stars. I love that cover.
Oh, good. I was listening to it today, and I really love it. Well, partly because Gareth Dixon, who plays guitar with me when we're playing live and has also recorded with me, I think he's just got such a beautiful way with guitar. And we worked on that song really, really well. And then the guy at Mojo said, oh, I thought I could give you another 2 weeks, but no, I need it now, tomorrow. So we had to quickly put it together. And, you know, in a way, that's really good when you're given that kind of time, that you've got to do it now and you can't mess around for 2 weeks, you know? So that's what came out.
Any kind of creative constraints or time constraints, almost always a good thing. What do you give that one?
I give that one a 5. I think we did a really good job of it, especially with Gareth.
We have the same taste in your material.
Oh, good.
And then my favorite of all your Devendra Banhart collaborations, Will I See You Tonight, from 2019, from Ma. Really great, dramatic, soaring strings on that, too. That one, I get 5. I love that song.
I loved that song as well. I loved recording it. I sent all kinds of different versions, but what they chose, I thought was absolutely right. It was really great.
And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but the last song you've participated in up to this point is The Avalanche's Reflecting Light.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh my goodness, that was such a wonderful thing. Really great. I thought, you know, for The Avalanches in this time to choose to sample a song from I wrote it in 1968. I recorded it in 1969 and it came out in 1970. And there it is on their album now.
They're sampling you.
Sampling Glowworms, yes.
I thought you were singing live on it. Okay, that's
No, it's a sample from Diamond Day.
Oh, that is cool. I did not realize that. That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah, so the last song you actively participated in was Will I See You Tonight?
Yes.
Okay. Wayward, Just Another Life to Live, as far as a book goes, a hard 5 stars. Thank you for forcing me to read.
Even though you have a 4-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, to say that I have to, it's for work, then they're off my back about it. So, you know, never, ever forget, Vashti, although I don't need to be the one to say it. I'm sure you say it every day. Perseverance furthers.
Oh, for goodness sake. It absolutely does. Yeah, it really, really does. I say it all the time.
Your life has borne that out. And I always do this toward the end of a show. One of the great things, and really the most wonderful thing, takeaway wise for me, when I take an entire recorded output into consideration, is the overview and shape of that arc. I mean, often it gives you insight into somebody's aesthetic life that they wouldn't see because you're taking it all in at once. But whether or not that's the case, here's the little thing that I wrote about ingesting everything you've ever done. From a cannon blast, yet abortive attempt at instant pop superstardom, to an immediate and more befitting graduation as mother figure to the cult artist scene, which is so much better and so much cooler, your arc is precisely who you are and the remarkable energy you emanate into this world, Vashti. Your music is but one component of an overwhelmingly impressive and well-lived life, but it is an excellent body of work as well. You should be proud, never ashamed. Don't hide your light, please, never again.
Oh, David, that is absolutely lovely. Thank you so much.
Your work has made me so happy, has given me and so many people I know such reassurance and, you know, the ability to take a deep breath and disengage from the horrors of the world without needing for those horrors to be spelled out. They're there. We know they're there. Yes. You're always a balm of calm.
That makes me feel that it was worthwhile. Thank you so much. Thank you.
So my top three records, and of course, with your catalog, this could change at any time. They're all as essential as the others. But I would say three, Heartleap, two, Look Aftering, one, Diamond Day. But very rarely do I have anyone on the show whose entire work is, you know, you need to take the whole thing in as crucial to understanding. There's no worst album. That would be ludicrous. You're Vashti Bunyan. So are you touring? Is it all about the memoir now?
Yes, it is. I've been doing all kinds of literary festivals and reading bits of the book and being interviewed by different people. And it's been a very different experience to music. The literary world is very different. And it's been fascinating. And I'm still working the book. And enjoying it, really enjoying speaking to different people like you who have a different view. Everybody has a different view, and it's very good for me to get all kinds of different ideas from it. And I hope to write some more, maybe. But I haven't done any more live shows since the book came out here last April, but hopefully there'll be some more.
I would definitely read a book about the Look Aftering days, not meaning the recording, but I mean, while you were Look Aftering from 1971 to 2000.
Right.
I know it kind of greets me as a whole. Like, I don't know what happened in there, but I think the idea is that the simple stuff that you were using to distract you from your own pain then just became the things that you did every day, period.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And I've mentioned in the book that the year in Ireland, when my baby was very little, and we went to Ireland for a whole year traveling with horses and wagons, and it was the most extraordinary year. It was 1970 into 1971. In the south of Ireland and traveling through into the north of Ireland. And the things that happened to us, I didn't want to go into in the book very much, but I have sort of hinted that there might be another story to tell there. And that year was extraordinary. And I am writing it. I'm finding it difficult, but I am writing it. And I hope to bring that to some kind of fruition over the next year or so.
Well, look, in stark contrast to what that jackass said when he wrote in his newspaper in 1971 about your record, I would say that there isn't a single thing that has emanated from you aesthetically that is less than completely essential.
Oh my.
Really? You know, the kinds of artists that are appealing to me and the people who listen to this show are the artists who walk it like they talk it. And man, do you. You need to have one with the other to really understand what it is you're putting out in the world. Yeah. You're just very appreciated on every level for all of that that you do.
Thank you. Well, I hope the book works. I hope that it explains a few things. You know, it was meant to explain a few things to my children, but I hope that it lays the ground for what happened with Diamond Day, what led to that album and the before and the after. I didn't want to dwell too much on details, but just to paint a picture of what happened at that time. And, you know, it was the 1960s and 70s. It was another world, another world. And I hope that I've managed to paint a picture of it that people will understand, maybe.
I think they will. I mean, it's written in a very straightforward manner, and the illustrations are wonderful. The one especially that is affecting for me is you all waving to the house with your backs.
Oh, yes.
What an amazing experience to have lived and to be able to write about it and inform people. It's inspiring.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
You too. Is there anything beyond the book or anything that you would like to plug? I know that kind of stuff is probably like anathema to you, but please, I'm giving you the floor.
Sure. Just thank you to Howard. He's been so great. I hope that people might be able to order the book through independent bookstores as much as from the dreaded Amazon. But I would love it to be something that independent bookstores might be able to order for people. That would please me hugely.
That being said, and I'm going to say this, if you can't get out today, just order it off Amazon. Just make sure you have it. It's a great book.
That's lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a
great day.
Thank
you so much, David.
Bye.
Bye for now.
All right, that about does it. A heartfelt Discog Graffiti thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Vashti Bunyan, the ever-patient Howard Wolfing, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the soldiers of sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discog Graffiti Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discog Graffiti Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, hey, no sweat. Just email me at info@discograffiti.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the limitless wonders of 1960s hippie living is to go straight to the beginning and listen to Pink Floyd, episodes 1 and 2, The Monkees, episodes 22 and 23, The Band, episodes 25 and 27, The Zombies, episodes 59 and 60, Sweetwater, episode 79, and Burt Summer, episode 83 and 84. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discog Graffiti's week-long homebound Lady of the Canyons deep dive. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday brings the Patreon-only wildcard episode, the Vashti Bunyan Bonus Show Part 2, in which we extended our chat and created an entirely separate episode a couple days later because it was so much fun the first time around. Not to mention Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discog Graffiti's The Private Press, A Letter Home, which is unquestionably the greatest Christmas album ever made. That's not at all a Christmas album. Not in the least, actually. Make sure you visit patreon.com/discograffiti and check out the thematically related deep dive as a music obsessive's way of life. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, July 21st, we're coming at you with an interview with Dreamy Loop hypnotists Lorraine. You're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discog Graffiti.